You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 10th of September 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Andrew Tuck. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, the Taliban would agree to a permanent ceasefire deal with NATO, allow them to keep military bases, and would even disown their own al-Qaeda partners. It's just how the West goes about it, according to a major new report on the war. We'll speak with one of its authors. And today, tiny Kosovo took another step towards being a state able to look after its own interests as international supervision of the young nation ended. To explain what it means, we'll be talking to our correspondent in the region, Adam Labor.
Although it's got the trappings of being a proper country and it's recognised by about 90 countries now, you still can't really say it's an independent state in charge of its own destiny.
And US cities are rightfully proud of the booming popularity of cycling on their streets. But why are so few of the recruits women? Then Monocle's foreign editor Steve Bloomfield will be in studio to look ahead at the events set to shape our week. Steve, what will you be looking at?
The big thing will be how it is a major, major week for the euro. There'll be some other stuff as well, but that's the main focus.
Good, all that. Plus, we'll be looking at why Austria's postmen have got the hump over being made to carry GPS tracking devices. All that, plus some music too, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House. But first, let's catch up on the news headlines with James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. Greece has acknowledged it's having trouble persuading its foreign lenders to accept a plan to save nearly 12 billion euros over the next 2 years. The savings are essential to unlock the aid payments the country needs in order to avoid bankruptcy. Hopes that Greece, now in its fifth straight year of recession, might get a quick green light on the package were dashed when inspectors rejected part of it after bilateral talks resumed on Sunday. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Navi Pillay, said that both sides in the Syria conflict were to blame for human rights abuses. Mrs. Pillay called for Syria to be referred to the International Criminal Court. However, such a referral can only be effected by the UN Security Council, which is split on how to deal with Syria. China and Russia oppose any attempt to lay the blame for the crisis on President Bashar al-Assad. Mrs. Pillay outlined her worries.
I'm gravely concerned by the ongoing conflict in Syria, which continues to have devastating consequences on civilians. The use of heavy weapons by the government and the shelling of populated areas have resulted in high numbers of civilian casualties, mass displacement of civilians inside and outside the country, and a devastating humanitarian crisis.
Sources in Yemen say armed forces in the country have killed Saeed al-Shehri, a man seen as the second in command of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. Yemen's Ministry of Defense website said Shehri was a Saudi national who was killed along with six other militants in an army operation in the remote Hadramaut province in eastern Yemen. It gave no more details. Dutch voters will head to the polls on Wednesday in a parliamentary election that's been shaping up as a close contest between caretaker Prime Minister Mark Rutte's pro-Euro Liberal Party and its old enemy the Labour Party, with its new charismatic leader Diederik Samsom. Mr. Samsom explained why a stronger euro was needed.
I'm supportive of the Eurogroup, even if it costs some money, because doing nothing and letting it fall apart will cost more. Spending enough money, that's what we need. And the austerity policy from the last 2 years didn't work. We need growth in Europe, and therefore we need a stronger euro.
At least 12 parties are running in the September the 12th elections, but the debates of the main six parties have been focusing on the eurozone crisis and austerity and its consequences for the country's generous welfare benefits and pensions. In India, the arrest of a cartoonist on sedition charges for drawings that satirise corruption in the country's political elite has rekindled a national debate on freedom of speech. The arrest comes weeks after a clampdown on Twitter in the world's largest democracy. Cartoonist Asim Trivedi turned himself in and was remanded in custody on Sunday. The arrest follows a private complaint over a series of cartoons, including one that depicts the Parliament building as a lavatory buzzing with flies. A close aide of anti-corruption campaigner Anna Hazare, Mayank Gandhi, spoke to media outside the police station in Mumbai, labelled Trivedi's arrest as unjustified.
This sedition law has been drafted by the British at that time to pressurise the Indians who were fighting against injustice and for freedom and independence. How can you use that for somebody, some innocent young boy who has just made a cartoon to say exactly what we have been saying? I mean, I'm sure all the press and so many people are saying that this country is being raped. So he just makes a visual depiction and you call it sedition. I think it is completely unjustified.
And those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, James. It's 18:05 here in London, and you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Dobro pozdravljat, Monocle 24.
Essa é Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, this.
Dette Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Det her Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
On Wednesday and Thursday this week, Monocle 24 heads to Helsinki. We'll be sitting down with the tastemakers behind the current world design capital in a city known for its design and architecture, with the reputation of good quality of life, efficiency and high tech. It's not just vodka, Santa Claus and reindeer, you see. That's Midori House on Wednesday and Thursday this week, right here on Monocle 24. Kippis ja kuulemiin.
When the NATO-led war in Afghanistan kicked off following the 9/11 attacks in New York and Washington, few at the time would have believed that Western troops would still be patrolling villages and conducting night raids on targets over a decade later. The Taliban insurgency has perplexed military planners and analysts since the beginning, and still no one is entirely certain how to end the bloodshed. A new report released by the British defence think tank RUSI, the Royal United Services Institute, is the most recent attempt to tackle the complex issue of just how to wrap up a war. Joining us on the line is Anatole Levin, one of the report's authors. He's also the author of Pakistan, A Hard Country, and lecturer in the War Studies Department at King's College London. Anatole, thank you very much for joining us. This report makes really fascinating reading. And I guess the headline for most people is the fact that there does seem to be a possibility of a negotiated peace in Afghanistan, according to the people that you've interviewed.
Yes. I mean, those are, of course, the things to emphasise. Only a possibility, and according to the people we interviewed, who, I must stress, you know, are not current Taliban leaders. They're former leading figures who remain in close touch with the organisation, and one Afghan mediator with the Taliban. So they're people who are close to the Taliban and know the Taliban very well. But of course this didn't represent, and indeed the Taliban have just come out and said this, this certainly didn't represent the agreed official position of the Taliban.
And of the things that you discovered while preparing this report, what were the most fascinating things that surprised you?
The most striking thing was that they all said that they thought that if the Taliban could get a settlement, which, you know, they could accept in every other way, that they thought they would even be prepared to accept a presence of U.S. military bases until 2024, which is the present agreement with the Afghan government. Now, that is pretty striking, if true, of course, but the very suggestion is striking because up to now, the Taliban have been absolutely categorical on a complete withdrawal of U.S. forces. Now, of course, there have been indications before that the Taliban would be prepared to negotiate, of course, over the time frame of a U.S. withdrawal, because, you know, even, you know, the hardest liners don't think they can simply vanish overnight. And I suppose at that point you get into the question of, well, how long is a time frame, which is a bit like saying how long is a piece of string. The other thing which was very striking was that while the Taliban will not agree to anything in advance, everything in their view, because that would be, from their point of view, surrender, everything will have to come as part of a generally negotiated settlement. We were told that they would exclude Al-Qaeda as part of a settlement, and that, of course, it would have to be renegotiated and re-ratified by a new constitutional process, but that the Taliban do not actually have many problems in principle with the existing Afghan constitution. Of course, they won't accept it as it stands because they believe that it, you know, it has to be accepted by a new and legitimate process. But it's not that the Taliban actually want to overturn it completely, according to the people we talked to.
So there's two really fascinating things there. One is this idea that they kind of regret their association with Al-Qaeda. Could you just explain to us a little bit why they've come to see that as a really poor partnership?
Well, even before 9/11, you know, there were quite a number of stories about Al-Qaeda members being very unhappy. With Taliban members being very unhappy about Al-Qaeda's presence, because they could see the trouble that they were drawing down on Afghanistan. Since then, it does seem that, you know, more and more Taliban people have come to think that Al-Qaeda has, in the words of one of our participants, wrecked our successful attempt, in their view, to create an Islamic State in Afghanistan. So that is not actually so surprising, nor in principle is the willingness to renounce Al-Qaeda, because there you have had official statements from the Taliban emphasizing that the Taliban does not conduct international terrorism, you know, is not an international militant force, you know, that its horizons are purely confined to Afghanistan. So that was, I mean, of course, it's very important. It's critical, you know, if the United States is to negotiate with the Taliban. But as I say, I think there one can see that there have been prior indications of this.
But one thing they don't seem willing to negotiate about is Hamid Karzai. They seem to despise him more than the Americans.
Yes, they do. Because they see Karzai as a complete American stooge. They think that he's morally completely rotten and corrupt. And I think as well, though, you know, this is not something that our interlocutors said, that they've come to recognize that they will have to negotiate with other ethnic groups in Afghanistan and share power with some of their representatives. But it's a quite different matter when it comes to fellow Pashtuns, who in their view have betrayed Afghanistan and sided with the invaders. So, there was absolute unanimity. Not just that Karzai, you know, would have to go, but that Karzai would have to go as part of the peace process, that Karzai could not remain there, you know, for example, while a new constitutional convention took place. Because, and here perhaps one might have some measure of agreement with them, they're quite convinced that Karzai would rig such a process.
Now, could you just give us some idea from, after speaking to these four people, what the country that they had envisaged or thought of, what it would slightly look like? Are we seeing a country that's, you know, a completely theocratic state? Because they hinted at that they were absolutely opposed still to mixed education, but they were not opposed to education of children. They still had concerns about how healthcare was delivered. They certainly didn't want it being delivered again in a way that men and women were in the same space. What kind of country do you think they're, is there something else we could think of as a similar model? Is it like Iran? Is it like northern Pakistan? What are they thinking of?
Well, of course, they are probably not at all clear themselves. And once again, I mean, the people we talk to obviously, you know, represent a pragmatic strain of opinion in the Taliban, but there are obviously much harder strains. I mean, I think a critical line which we heard from them was that the Taliban now realize that you can't simply go back to pre-9/11. You can't simply go back to a government of mullahs. That to run a modern state, yes, you can have the mullahs, and yes, here Iran might be a model, providing, you know, moral leadership and guidance, but that you need technocrats. It may be, though this is purely my own analysis, I should say, that they've noticed these reports of huge mineral and energy reserves in Afghanistan, and they realize that to exploit those, you know, they're going to need technocrats. But of course, recognizing the need for technocrats brings things with it. It brings the need for elements of a modern education system, and it also involves giving these people a certain space for their lives, you know, because otherwise they'll go away, they won't serve you anymore. So it involves, you know, that also involves a measure of power sharing. I mean, as far as education are concerned, they all said, well, once again, these are very much on the pragmatic side. This is not the whole Taliban. That the Taliban is all for women's education in principle. And, you know, one of them said, of course, you know, we need women doctors, you know, to treat other women and things like that. But beyond a certain age, the education has to be completely separate. Well, I mean, how you set up a modern education system in which men and women are completely separated, which, by the way, they're not in Iran, for example, that's a difficult question. Clearly, this is the kind of thing which they themselves, I think, have not thought through.
Well, it's a really fascinating report, and thank you, Anatole, for joining us. That was Anatole Levin, who's lecturer in the War Studies Department at King's College and co-author of that report. And now joining us on the line to broaden the discussion a little bit further is Fawez Jerjes, who's the Professor of Middle Eastern Politics and International Relations at the London School of Economics. Welcome, Fawez. It was really fascinating to listen to that. Do you think there are other examples around the world where we've seen negotiations take place that would be a good kind of roadmap for actually for Afghanistan as well?
Well, I don't think there are really specific case studies similar, and we can really take wholeheartedly and say, well, look, this case applies in the case of Afghanistan. I think we have similar models. I think we have during the Vietnam War. The Americans were led to believe that the Viet Cong would be were willing to basically compromise, were willing to accept a division of political, labor in Vietnam to share power with South Vietnam. And the reality is that particular model did fail dismally because basically we know what happened in the 1970s. Once the Americans left Vietnam, basically, the Marxists decided to seize power and take it all. We have also the model in Iraq itself, but Iraq is a different case. Iraq, the Americans were able to help construct basically 500,000 security man apparatus in the country. They left in place a huge security apparatus that has been able to maintain order as opposed to law. But the reality is Iraq still work in progress. I think Afghanistan differs substantively from both Vietnam and Iraq for a variety of reasons. I think the Taliban know very well that they cannot really on their own basically seize power in the whole country, even if the Americans pull out of Afghanistan in the next few years, which I doubt very much. Secondly, I think Afghanistan is a very complex society. There is a distribution of power not only within the various factions and within the Taliban, but various, tribes and social constituencies. Afghanistan is a highly complex society. Plus, you have Pakistan, you have Iran, and, of course, you have the United States and India as well. And finally, I would argue that after so many years of bloodshed and war, I think the Taliban know very well that they cannot really basically win this prolonged struggle in Afghanistan, and that's why I think the interviews were fascinating because they reinforced, they confirm what we know about what has happened in Afghanistan in the last few years, that the Taliban are not a monolith, they are factionalized and divided. Secondly, we know that there is a very moderate element within the political establishment in within the Taliban. And also we know that there has been a major divide, a major cleavage between the Taliban as a whole and Al-Qaeda and the global jihad. I think one of the most fascinating, that what comes out of the interviews is that basically the Taliban know that Al-Qaeda is gone for good and that any particular, they must cut the umbilical cord with the global jihadist movement as represented by Al-Qaeda.
And Fawaz, could you just tell me, finally, how would this process begin, do you think? Do you need an honest negotiator in the form of another state? Do you need a Qatar to kind of step in and be the broker? Or do you need to, could the Americans do it directly by contacting the people closer to Mullah Omar, or do you have to form some kind of jirga, this traditional way of meeting in Afghanistan? How could you imagine the process beginning?
Well, I think you're asking really very, very important questions and tells you a great deal about how complex the Afghan case is because it involves multiple players. It involves ideational values, religion in particular, and Islamic values. It involves the Taliban movement, a very ultra-conservative, religiously based movement. I would argue that we really don't, let's not underestimate what has transpired between the Americans and various aspects of the Taliban. The Americans have been engaged in political talks with various elements of the Taliban. This is open knowledge. I'm not saying anything really original. So in this particular sense, I think the talks have taken place, and I think Qatar and other players, in particular Saudi Arabia, are trying to mediate between the two players. I would argue the reason why I think the interviews, the report is really fascinating, I would argue both the Americans and the Taliban are exhausted. And if history serves as a guide, if we have learned one lesson about how wars end, how civil wars end, is that when both camps are exhausted, both camps are willing to compromise. The Americans want to bring their forces home. The war itself is very unpopular in America. It's very costly. And the Taliban realize they cannot win this prolonged and difficult struggle. And that's why you have an opening, a window of opportunity that might produce a settlement in the next 2 years or so.
Great. Thank you very much, Fawaz. That was Fawaz Jerjes, who's the Professor of Middle Eastern Politics and International Relations at the London School of Economics. And we'll be right back.
Nestled into the urban fabric of London, Hong Kong, New York and Tokyo, Monocle shops are small, cosy outposts of everything we care about. That's incredible design, credible provenance, charming service and, of course, intelligent journalism. Stock up on the latest issue of the magazine, browse our carefully curated selection of books and music, or seek out your favourite back issue to fill that gap in your Monocle archive. So drop in to one of our shops and our friendly staff will be on hand to show you around. For addresses and opening hours, visit monocle.com.
A bit like a documentary film, but without any pictures.
There are some actors, there are quite a lot of musicians.
Festival.
Galleries. Bands.
You are cordially invited to tune in to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. The show that wants to tell you about the music, art, books, films and media we think you should know about wherever in the damn world you've pitched your tent.
Some people collect shoes and other people collect Ferraris. I collect art.
In the latest edition, we'll get a uniquely amusing digest of the recently run Democratic and Republican conventions from US comedian Rich Fulcher, and we'll shoot the breeze with the director and executive producers of a pretty incendiary film about LCD Sound System's final gig.
We weren't looking to definitively answer any of the questions that were being asked because there isn't one reason why the band ended. We were more looking to make a film that in some way conveyed how it felt to be there that night.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. Today, the 25-nation group that's been supervising Kosovo's path to statehood since it declared independence from Serbia in 2008 said that its task was officially done. But that doesn't mean all is peace and happiness in the capital, Pristina. There are still uneasy tensions with the government in Belgrade, and several EU nations have not recognised the country's independence. Adam Labor is Monocle's Budapest correspondent, who's been reporting regularly on Kosovo, and a little earlier I spoke to him about today's events and what the country needs to do next. I began by asking him if today's events were truly significant.
Well, they are significant in the sense that it's a major step towards full sovereignty, but at the same time it highlights the contradictions of Kosovo, that although it's got the trappings of being a proper country and it's recognised by about 90 countries now, you still can't really say it's an independent state in charge of its own destiny.
And what's holding it back from reaching that? Is it still, obviously there's a simmering dispute that carries on with Serbia, who still doesn't recognise its independence, which it seized in 2008?
That's a large part of it, of course, because the dispute with Serbia's failure to recognise Kosovo is kind of stopping it from integrating into the Balkans. So that's why you've got this sort of contradictory situation. I mean, Kosovo is a very small place, and as a state on its own, it's probably not really viable. Its natural partner and neighbour is, of course, Serbia, but Serbia doesn't recognise it. and northern Kosovo, which is where the majority of the Serbs still inside Kosovo lives, doesn't really recognize Kosovo either and would rather be part of Serbia. So it sort of goes round and round in a circle and nothing really gets fixed.
And tell me, I can understand why Serbia would be reluctant to recognize its independence, but why have other kind of EU states, there's a few that have also kind of refused to kind of recognize the country. And as you say, there's actually out of all the UN nations, there must be quite a few even there who have failed to kind of come up in support for Kosovo.
Yes, a large number of countries still don't recognise it. In particular, for example, Slovakia doesn't recognise Kosovo. That's because it sees it as a very dangerous precedent. Slovakia has a substantial minority of Hungarians, about 200,000 out of the 5 million or so people who live in Slovakia are ethnic Hungarians. So it thinks if it recognises Kosovo, it sort of sends a green light to the Hungarians saying, actually, we want to secede or become autonomous or join with Hungary or something, even though that's actually very unlikely. Another one who doesn't recognise it is Cyprus. And of course, you know, Cyprus is just an endless dispute over the Greek and Turkish enclaves. So a country that's already divided like that and has got such bad atmosphere between the two sides is certainly not going to recognize a country that it sees as having just split off from its motherland and declared itself independence. So it's Kosovo kind of setting a precedent which many states don't welcome.
Now, you've been there. Give us a little bit of color about what it's like to be on the ground in Kosovo and what it's like to be in the capital, Pristina.
Well, I went there for Monaco when the country declared its independence, and on that day it was exciting. There was definitely a sense of something new happening and a new country coming into the world. There was a lot of elation there, and I understand that because Kosovo did suffer appallingly during the end years of the Milosevic regime, when there was an incredible amount of war crimes and ethnic cleansing and all sorts of hideous things happened, and NATO had to come to the rescue. But at the same time, in the capital, Pristina, you are struck by how very small this place is. And I remember walking down the main street and thinking, how are you going to turn this into a country? I mean, it doesn't really have much resources or industry. Even, you know, neighboring Albania has brilliant potential for tourism, although they haven't really exploited that. But there's not a lot of particular reasons to go to Kosovo in terms of tourism or attracting investment. And I do remember very clearly thinking, how's it going to work? And what we see today is still a lot of problems.
And one of those problems is really endemic corruption throughout the system, which isn't rare in that part of the world, unfortunately. But is it holding back Kosovo, do you think?
Oh, definitely. I think the amount of corruption there and the substantial presence of crime as well, it puts investors off. I mean, one of the things we've learned in this region since the collapse of communism in 1990 is the crucial importance of foreign investments. Now, countries like Hungary and Poland and the Czech Republic have soared ahead because of foreign money. Now, what does foreign investment want? It wants legal stability. It wants a degree of transparency. They know they're not operating in Finland or New Zealand, but they want some sense of accountability and the rule of law and a stable tax system. Now, those things haven't really taken root in Kosovo yet.
Now, if you were the Kosovan PM, what would be the next kind of two or three things on your list that you'd want ticked off as you kind of progress to really trying to be a proper country?
Well, I'd want to make it much more attractive to foreign investors. I'd want to show that there really is the rule of law here, that if you put your money in, it's going to be safe. And I'd want to show that there's a serious crackdown going on against corruption and crime.
And do you think there's any opportunity for negotiations with Serbia to begin and for there to be some kind of peace between the two?
Well, there's always an opportunity, and I very much hope that opportunity is taken. But at the moment, in Serbia, you're seeing, because there's a big disillusionment in Serbia, you know, it hasn't really made much progress towards joining the European Union, while Croatia's going in pretty soon. There's a lot of disillusionment there, and there's not really much appetite in the government to make a lot of progress and make concessions on Serbia, because essentially there's not a lot of things that Serbia can do other than ultimately recognize Kosovo, which it really doesn't want to do and would be seen as a big defeat for any Serbian government. There's not that much in it for them, although it would speed up integration into the European Union. But there's a big enlargement fatigue in the EU anyway, so there's not a lot of enthusiasm for bringing Serbia in.
Well, Adam, thank you very much for talking to us. That was Adam Labor, who's our Budapest correspondent and also our correspondent for the region. Now, in the next half hour of the programme, we'll be tracking down unhappy Austrian postmen and also trying to find out why women are refusing to cycle in America. But first, here's James Luckhurst with the news headlines.
Greece has acknowledged it's having trouble persuading its foreign lenders to accept a plan to save nearly 12 billion euros over the next 2 years. The savings are essential to unlock the aid payments the country needs in order to avoid bankruptcy. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Navi Pillay, said that both sides in the Syrian conflict are to blame for human rights abuses. Mrs. Pillay called for Syria to be referred to the International Criminal Court. Sources in Yemen say armed forces in the country have killed Saeed al-Shehri, a man seen as the second in command of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. The country's Ministry of Defense website said Shehri was a Saudi national who was killed along with six other militants in an army operation in the remote Hadramut province in eastern Yemen. Dutch voters will head to the polls on Wednesday in a parliamentary election that's been shaping up as a close contest between caretaker Prime Minister Mark Rutte's pro-Euro-liberal party and its old enemy, the Labour Party, with its new charismatic leader, Diederik Samsom. At least 12 parties are running in the elections. The debates of the main six have been focusing on the Eurozone crisis and austerity. And in India, the arrest of a cartoonist on sedition charges for drawings that satirise corruption in the country's political elite has rekindled a national debate on freedom of speech. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
And you're back with Midori House on Monocle 24, coming to you live from Studio One in London. Now, US cities are seeing surging numbers of cyclists taking to their streets. From New York to San Francisco, Portland to Boulder, the two-wheeled revolution is at full pelt, thanks to more enlightened city hall policies, rising fuel prices, and a general love of riding around. But John Pucher and Ralph Buhler, the authors of a new book called City Cycling, have spotted a problem. The new cycle converts are nearly all men, aged 25 to 64, and the number of women cyclists is actually in decline in many places. So what's gone wrong? Joining us on the line now from Alexandria, Virginia, is Ralph Buhler. Ralph, thank you very much for coming on to the show today. Could you tell us, why is this? Why are women so reluctant to jump on their bikes in American cities?
Good evening. Thank you very much for having me. I think the reluctance you are describing is something that has traditionally been the case in countries with lower cycling levels, fewer bike facilities. And so we have had in the U.S. and Canada, but also in the U.K., we have had only about 30% of cyclists as women, while in bike-friendly Western European countries such as Denmark, or Germany, or the Netherlands, we had 50% of cyclists, female cyclists. So I think we're seeing sort of a little bit of an extension of the existing conditions, and I think the main reason is the lack of bike infrastructure and much more lack of safety in cycling in many U.S. and Canadian cities.
It was interesting this morning when we were discussing this story at our morning conference. A couple of the women who were in the conference said, well, actually, it's also other cyclists I don't like. That when you come up against male cyclists, they're very aggressive. They cut you up. You know, they push with their elbows to get past you. It feels that actually the cycling world isn't always very welcoming to women either.
I think that in the past, with very low cycling levels in the U.S., cyclists were a smaller group, mainly younger, risk-taking men. So you have a certain group of society that cycles. And now we see more and more other people, like women, older individuals, or children, picking up cycling, and sort of that group has to enlarge. I think in general, cyclists would be favorable of that. There may be a small group that's not favorable of enlarging that group, but I think in the vast majority, I think cyclists would be in favor to enlarge their numbers.
Now, we said that it's even, you know, quite a strict category of men as well. It's from 25 plus, it seems to be the majority of people who are jumping on their bikes. What can city halls do to kind of broaden the appeal of cycling?
I think there are many things, and as I said before, I think the key is probably increasing cycling safety and also perceived cycling safety. In study after study, when you ask men or women about the perceived safety of cycling, women always rate it to be more dangerous. And also, if you show people different pictures of different bike facilities versus cycling in the street, women tend to rate separate facilities more highly than men. So if we were to build separate networks of bike lanes and bike paths, as it's the case in many bike-friendly European countries, we'd see more women on these facilities. But at the moment, many U.S. cities are still at a stage where you have bike lanes and bike paths at some places, but then you'll have to cycle in traffic across that dangerous intersection all on your own. And once we get to that stage to have a network, we'll see more women. I think some cities like Portland may already be there getting there quite close for U.S. standards.
And also, just tell me, when you look at, in a more general sense across the big U.S. cities, who's getting it right? Who's leading the way with this cycling revolution?
So in terms of the larger cities, it's Portland. It's clearly Portland, Oregon, that is clearly leading the way. Since the early 1990s, they have aggressively expanded their bike infrastructure, but also they've implemented bike transit integration, bike training courses. They have traffic calmed neighborhoods. So these are streets where cars go so slow that you don't have to provide special bike infrastructure, but cars and bicycles share the road in these neighborhoods. Portland is also followed by more unlikely candidates, such as cold Minneapolis, Minnesota, which also has a high share of, like the second highest share of bike commuters in the U.S. There are, of course, smaller cities where there has been traditionally higher levels of cycling, such as Boulder, Colorado, or Davis, California, or Madison, Wisconsin. And then we have the large cities such as Washington, D.C., New York City, San Francisco, and Chicago that try to push really hard at the moment, but they are in the earlier stages compared to Portland or even Minneapolis.
And is there a kind of a unified reason why mayors are adopting these policies of being pro-bike? Is it because they feel that their transport systems are creaking? Are they trying to make their cities fitter so that they attract more investment? What is it that's driving this move?
I think sort of all of the above. On the one hand, it's relatively cheap or inexpensive to build bike infrastructure as compared to building new transit systems or widening highways. It's also very space efficient. If you have more people in the U.S. moving back into the city, and they're moving there because of the urban lifestyle, you don't have that much space to move cars around or to move everyone in the cars, or having the bicyclist very space efficient. Many more people, especially the younger, are more environmentally conscious, so want to do something good for the environment. And then on a very personal basis, many individuals want to walk or cycle for their health benefits, just their very selfish health benefits. From a mayor's perspective, you may look at that from a population health perspective, saying if you have a more active populace, you may have a healthier populace.
And tell me, when you look at the kind of the commuter rates for cycling, say, in a Copenhagen, in a Stockholm, do you think that you will ever see that level of commuting in a large metropolitan area in the U.S.?
I think we'd have to see. These rates are pretty high. So if you look at Amsterdam or Copenhagen, you get 30% or beyond 30%. I think at the moment, if you look at Portland, Oregon, they are at 6% or maybe close to 8%, but I think closer to 6%. So I don't think we'll see these 30% anytime soon, but cities can increase their cycling quite a bit. And even some European cities like Berlin, for example, they went from 5% in 1990 to now more than 10%. So there's a lot of room to increase. If we'll see the 30%+ within in the next decade or so, I don't think so, but we'll be moving in that direction.
And Ralph, just tell me a little bit about your book, City Cycling. What is it, a kind of manifesto for getting the U.S. on its bikes?
I'm not sure if I would call it a manifesto. So what we noticed is we have this cycling renaissance in the U.S., but also in Canada, Australia, and in Western European countries. And we are sort of documenting that bicycle renaissance in all of these countries. We're looking at different aspects on how are policies implemented and why do people cycle. So we have chapters on safety, on bike infrastructure, on bike transit integration, on women, on children and cycling, on small cities, large cities, mega cities. And then we conclude with sort of lessons from the cities and the countries we looked at on how to implement bike-friendly measures and to increase cycling levels. So it's very much at the pulse of the time.
Can I ask you, it was interesting, you know, hearing Romney making his speech the other day when he was declaring that, you know, he was laughing at Obama trying to do anything to kind of save the world. But actually on the lower level, are you quite inspired by Americans? Because in fact, they're doing lots of things which are quite green, quite environmental, quite, you know, good for the, you know, for their cities. Is there a kind of a revolution that's happening away from the big world of politics?
I think it is, and as my accent may tell you, I'm originally from Germany, and I'm in the U.S. now for 10, 11 years. And I think even in this short time period I've been here, I've seen big changes in the attitudes of people towards the environment and the willingness of doing good for the environment or being environmentally friendly. I think most of it is not happening on the federal level of government, but more on the city level or the state level. I think mainly on the city levels. It's cities, mayors and city councils that want to be green, and they are changing from the bottom up.
Well, that was really, really interesting to speak to you. That was Ralph Buhler, who's the co-author of City Cycling. And you're listening to Midori House, and we're going to be right back after this with a chat about foreign affairs with Steve Bloomfield.
Monocle 24 is growing. We're proud to introduce The Stack, a new programme on air every Saturday. This lively one-hour show is a celebration of the print media, exploring the best in periodicals, niche journals and newspapers, and talking to people from around the world who are pushing the sector forward and shaping the media landscape. Running on Saturdays at 10 a.m. UK time and repeated on Sundays, the show is an intimate conversation around a coffee table stacked with interesting magazines and newspapers from around the globe, hosted by Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brûlé. That's The Stack, every Saturday morning at 10 a.m. UK time, repeated on Sundays and available online. Brought to you in association with J.Crew.
Wherever you're going this summer, and whether it's for work or play, let Monocle's editors be your travel companions. We've just refreshed and revised our team's guides to the world's top business cities and resorts, so you can have our 25-25 travel guide series in the palm of your hand with the Monocle app, available from iTunes, or download free guides from monocle.com. From São Paulo to New York, Capri to St. Bart's, we can show you where to long lunch or go for your morning run. Just head to the iTunes App Store and download the Monocle app. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And it's time now for a roundup of the news stories. Keep an eye on this week with our foreign editor. That's right, isn't it? Foreign affairs editor, it says here.
Really?
You're foreign editor, just foreign editor, not yeah. Foreign affairs. That sounds a bit sleazy.
That's different, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, you never know. You have been going away rather a lot, I've noticed. You never know. Anyway, we'll glide on from there. Steve Bloomfield's here. Welcome, Steve, it says here. And you're very welcome. Can I just say that it's been a very good show so far, so the pressure's on. Don't drop the ball.
Okay. I've been listening. I'm not entirely sure you're right, to be honest. It has. It's been fascinating.
Sony have already been on about entering for a Sony Award.
No, that was the bloke from Sony about fixing your radio.
Oh, okay. That's what that was about. Yeah. Now, what's the story that you want to bring up first, Steve?
So, big week. I mentioned this over the weekend on the Monocle Weekly. And we're going to be talking about it again tomorrow on the briefing. But it's worth repeating. Very big week for the euro. Put us in some context. The entire euro crisis solving mechanism, that's a technical term, that the European Stability Mechanism, it's about 500 billion euros. It's going to hopefully, you know, save the world. Germany is a little bit unhappy about it because obviously Germany stumps up most of the cash. And despite the fact that it passed both House of Parliament in Germany with a two-thirds majority, that has been a petition has been taken to the German Constitutional Court saying this is unconstitutional in Germany. They heard arguments back in July, and there's going to be a result on Wednesday in Karlsruhe at the Constitutional Court. If the court says no, this is unconstitutional, then the entire euro bailout is completely up in the air.
Is there any kind of inkling of what the judge will say? What the legal people or the commentators saying?
It's most likely that they will say it's sort of all right, but it's obviously very, very hard to predict. And it's also quite hard to work out how much of that is down to wishful thinking, that people just really, really want this to definitely be okay, because otherwise we have no other ideas. But I think it goes to the heart of, you know, what the euro and what the European Central Bank are really supposed to do. And the European Central Bank has been, although it's becoming a bit more, interfering a little bit more in a good way. It has been a very, very hands-off in the past, saying, well, we've got these very strict rules and we can't, you know, not stick by these very strict rules. The problem is, if they don't bend these rules a little bit, and certainly the European Stability Mechanism, you could argue, bends the rules a little bit, if they don't bend the rules, then the whole thing could fall apart. And really, what's the point in being able to say, oh, well, we stuck by the rules, if the euro's fallen apart?
It feels like a back-to-school week for the euro, doesn't it? Because the Greeks are back in trouble again. The Portuguese are looking at further austerity measures to kind of keep up with the fact that their tax returns have fallen so fast. It's just a story that is going to be dogging us for months and months, isn't it?
By dogging us, do you mean dogging us here at Monocle 24? Every day, like, oh God, I've got to do something about the euro again. No, you're right, and it is. And it's. I think I've used this line before, that, you know, it's a story which is both boring and terrifying at the same time.
Now, something that's not boring.
No.
We're also going to
talk terrifying.
About, no, all very good. We're going to talk about the conclusion of the Olympics, the summer of sport in GB.
So today was cloudy. It was clearly the start of autumn. People were a little bit grumpy on the tube. Something had changed. And that something was the fact that the Paralympic ceremony, closing ceremony happened last night. The Olympics and the Paralympics are entirely over now, completely. There was a victory parade today for the British athletes. There was a fly pass by the Red Arrows, which looked rather dramatic. But it is completely, absolutely over now. And we're left with a feeling of, initial feeling of, but on the whole, it's just been an incredible summer. Not just of sport, but of really sort of summing up what Britain is right now.
And what I love is that everybody is claiming the Olympics for their kind of for themselves. You know, so the union leaders are meeting at the moment here in the UK, and they're saying that it's a fine example of why you need government investment, why you need to spend money. This is the only way you ever get anything done. Lots of planning, big projects are good. You have the kind of Tories claiming it for themselves. It's been one of these events that everybody's kind of seen themselves reflected in, you know, literally across the political spectrum, across the national perspective as well.
It has, and also it's an event that all politicians have been able to agree on, or pretty much all, that it's a good thing. And it involved a lot of cross-party support and cooperation, which we rarely see in everyday life, so that's a good thing. But it's also just, you know, whether it's a Muslim Somali migrant like Mo Farah, winning gold, you know, being watched by more than 10 million people on TV, and, you know, with a Union Jack around him, or whether it's David Weir in a wheelchair winning the marathon again over the weekend. It just showed all sides of British life that don't always necessarily come together.
I was going to ask you that when one of the closing speeches yesterday, there was this line about, you know, that if you kind of turned over a product and you saw, you know, made in Britain, this was an event made in Britain, and that was clearly a line, you know, actually encouraging people to go and buy products made in Britain. How we talk often here about soft power and about how you can use your nation's brand to deliver good business and to change your society. Do you think there will be long-term benefits from the Olympics?
I think there's potential. There's certainly potential. Britain's been quite bad at selling itself to itself, let alone to the rest of the world, for quite some time. We've, as a country, been a little bit unsure as to how do we describe what Britain is nowadays. And I think it's possible. But having said that, you know, Seb Coe said last night, you know, yes, it's stamped on the bottom of products which show they're great. It says made in Britain. Very few products these days do actually have made in Britain stamped on them. And even those that are made in Britain don't tend to have the Union Jack on them or a Made in Britain logo. Maybe that will persuade them to start doing that sort of thing.
I wasn't very cheery at the end, but Steve, can I say you didn't...
Well, you can't have come.
No, yeah.
It was sort of, you know.
No, it was good. It was good. It was nuanced. Yeah. But you certainly didn't drop a ball. That was like juggling supreme.
Thanks.
I'm very proud of you. It was good. We're going to move on because you're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And Monocle 24 Tagat, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 is your cousin.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Propojalava.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. Some Austrian posties are not very happy. Their bosses have decided that they need to carry tracking devices to reveal their every move. But while the postmen and women claim that this is all about spying on them, the management insists it's just an attempt to run a more efficient and modern service. To tell us his take on this little upset, we're now joined on the line by Stephen Fuchs, who's the press spokesman for the Austrian Post. Hello, Stefan, and thank you very much for coming on to talk to us. Could you just explain to us why has the Austrian Post decided to make the postman carry these GPS systems?
Well, good evening, hello, nice of you to invite me to have this this short talk with you. It wasn't our purpose, firstly, to introduce this GPS system. What we have is now a modern system, modern handheld devices for our mailmen and also for our customers. These are, and many people know them already, of parcel companies, distributors, where you sign the parcel when you get it. And these modern devices are, as nearly every cell phone today is, equipped with a GPS device. So we agreed on not using this device, this GPS tracking, for most of the time. There's only the possibility if the workers or the mailman has a lot of overtime hours to activate this tracking system for a month, for 31 days, to see is it all right. Maybe it's the reason for him having all these overtime hours is that his district, his delivery district, is too big. And so we do have a modern system of tracking him and seeing if the district is right or if it's too big or too small, on the other hand.
But you're not trying to find out whether he's kind of cheekily stopping for kind of cafe and kuchen in the afternoon, or that he's kind of...
Well, everyone is free. He has the possibility of making a pause. He can also sign in and say on the handheld, well, I'm now out for my pause. As long as he gets all his letters done and delivered, it's all right for us to have a pause during the day. No, the thing is that we can track him, of course, but only twice a year. And we have to tell him first. That's what we agreed on with the workers' union. And so, on the one hand, the company is allowed to track the mailman twice a year. On the other hand, if the mailman thinks, well, my district is too big, he has also got the possibility to be tracked just to check if his district is really too big, and so we can find new solutions for him. It's an advantage for both sides.
And if he's taking a very, very long time over his round, will you share the results with his wife?
No, I'm not going to show that to anyone. Of course not.
And just very quickly, could you just tell me finally, Austrian Post, you know, I know that Swiss Post is very vibrant and successful still. Is Austrian Post still a very successful company?
Oh, yes, we are. Unfortunately, we are. We haven't been all the time, but in the last 6 or 7 years, we do have nice figures, and the facts are, everyone can see it, and also our shares in the share market prove it, that we're doing a real good job. We all together, there are 20,000 of us in all of Austria, and every single one of them is doing a wonderful job, and that's why we can have all these opportunities to get modern techniques into our business, which also helps our mailman. And that's wonderful.
Stefan, it was really nice to talk to you. That was Stefan Fuchs, who's a press spokesman for the Austrian Post. Now we're going to have a little bit more music from Austria, in fact. This is Waldeck with Memories.
All the souvenirs in my memories got me ruining my soul. But if you tell me what I should be offering,
and that was Waldeck, the toast of Österreich with Memories. And that's it, I'm being told, for today's show. I'd hope to fit in a lot more, but here, who knows. Our producer today was Daniel Giacopelli, and our researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Chris Fitch. Up next after the news is this week's episode of Culture with Robert Bound. And then in 3 hours' time, that's at 2200 London time, Andrew Muller and Robert Bound will be back again for the Monocle Daily. And then Ted Kravitz will be here tomorrow with Midori House at the same time. And then don't forget, for the next 2 days, we've got two special Midori Houses which will be coming to you live from Helsinki. I'm going to be there co-hosting with Mr. Marcus Hippie, and they're going to be a damn fine show, so stay around for those. But for now, from me, Andrew Tuck, it's time to say goodbye.